Hello, and welcome back to the AWS Developer Podcast. My name is Caroline Gluck, and this is the fourth part of a six-part series, Getting Schooled in Architecture, where we are going over the AWS Solution Architect Associate Exam. Today, we are going to be talking about designing high-performant architectures. And if you missed the past three, please go back and give them a listen. We have covered the overview of the SA exam, designing secure architectures, and designing resilient architectures. I'm really happy to welcome back Ted and Anya. Guys, thanks for joining us again.
Really glad to be here again.
Thank you so much for having us, Caroline.
What have you guys been up to since our last episode?
Well, I've been teaching a little bit. So one of the cool aspects of my position at AWS is I get to be in front of our customers talking about this and walking people through labs. So I've had a lot of fun with that. Next week, I am off to Columbia, Maryland to go hang out with some students, and I'll have about 30 students with me. So I love my job. I think I've got the best gig in IT just because I get to talk about cool technology all day.
Man, I would love to take one of your classes, Ted. You're just like one of those energetic people. I could see you in front. When the caffeine's wearing off, you would have me leaning in. I'm super curious. Like, what is the in-person training like nowadays in March 2024? I mean, I remember sitting down taking classes at training centers, like back when I was doing. Is it still like that? Are you going to corporate clients and like directly on site and doing things? Like, how does that world look? I'm just super curious.
Yes, all of that. So sometimes sometimes I'm at a client site. Sometimes I'm at a training center somewhere that's been rented out. And then sometimes I am in front of a green screen in my home office teaching virtually. And I think that's probably more of what I do these days than anything else post-pandemic. But I love the travel. I love being in front of people. It is such a difference than a virtual class.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. You realize we're all in this together and we're just winging it.
Exactly.
I've got to agree on that. A lot of my meetings are also virtual with my customers in terms of the technical meetings, but it's always great to be with customers in person. It's like a next level to just gain that trust with them and understand what it is they're really doing with their workloads. And you always come away with something you typically wouldn't get in a virtual meeting. It's just something is always a little bit missing. And I found like opportunities really open up for future work with customers after in-person meetings. And it's just fun getting some face-to-face time. So I've got to agree on all of that.
Yeah, I had an interesting conversation today with some customers because I was talking to two sign language interpreters who will be in my class next week.
Oh, that's awesome.
I thought was pretty cool. And I've had that happen before. And I've done instruction even virtually where I've had blind students in class. And, you know, as we're talking about preparing for the solutions architect exam, one question is, you know, who can be a solutions architect? And I think it doesn't really matter what your background is. There is such a variety of people doing this role and filling this role around the world. I think it's pretty interesting.
100% agree. And the other thing I was going to add, if you're interested to getting more involved in this community and you don't know where to start, a really good place to start is just checking LinkedIn or Meetup for any kind of local meetups that you might have revolving around AWS. It's very common that you might have a local AWS community that already organizes regular meetings, and you can join in person or virtually and just learn more and connect with people who are doing similar things. And sometimes they host workshops or some kind of training events. And that's a great way to get started.
Yeah, and something I actually learned recently about those meetups is they're often run by AWS employees, even though it's through the meetup site. So I didn't realize how officially we are involved in that, or unofficially our people are involved in that. So it's a really great source of knowledge.
Agreed.
All right. So, Anya, do you want to kick us off? What are we talking about today?
Oh, yes. Let's get back to those high-performing architectures, should we, Caroline? So one thing that we really wanted to start focusing on is storage, right? It's one of the core pillars of any application, and we always need some of it. And it really depends on what it is you're trying to build, right? AWS can address different kinds of needs in terms of storage. And we have multiple types of services that address your needs. So we always push off from the need of the customer and their application to select it. But a storage solution we wanted to start out with that almost anybody would be able to relate to is object storage. That's when you store any kind of object that you can think of, any kind of file type, whether it's a text file or if it's a video file or a CSV file or anything like that. So just a great variety of files. So we have a service that would serve that need. And it's pretty straightforward. It's called Simple Storage Service, or S3, because it has three S's. So a lot of people are aware of that storage.
Did you ever see Elf, where he's like Santa, and he's like, I know him. That's what I'm doing right now when you said S3.
Yes. So that is something that a lot of our customers start out with, right? Because it is so common. And even if they're not used, it is the first service that AWS offers. So many people are very familiar with that. Even if they may not be using other services that AWS offers, they are using S3 for different kinds of backup and storage solutions on S3.
I'm always so proud when I go to a restaurant and I scan the menu and the little like S3 public link comes up and the PDF pops up on like an AWS S3 link. And I'm like,
that's what I do. Look at me, Mom.
I know.
I would keep calling the waiter over during the pandemic. I'd be like, you know, you could get your own custom, you know, URL instead of showing, you know.
Does that happen when you're out and about, Ted? Is your SO like, don't talk to them about AWS? Like, because you do it all the time when you're out and you're like, you know, you could host a site with this, or you could move a mobile to this, or I can help you move the menu over here. Is that like part of your personality?
That is part of my personality. My wife, just, you know, hand across the backside of my head when no one's looking, of course.
Well, I remember when I first started studying computer science and the first time it clicked, like I was in college and I had like one other friend that I was like super close with, like outside of class. And we were like at the bar and we couldn't stop thinking about everything in terms of like zeros and ones. And like, we're just like standing in the corner, like, but how would you program that? And I'm like, we got to stop.
Yeah.
We have to shake it. No one's going to want to talk to us.
No, that is great, because the way we work as human beings, it's actually called schemas, which is why it's so important that you learn about everything. Because the more that your brain learns about things, you connect the schemas and it actually gives you a different dimension to look at problems. That's why developers I know that play music, or they know philosophy and history and all these other subjects, it comes together. They come up with some of the most brilliant solutions. And so that's great. And it's great to be excited about it. And no one calls you a nerd anymore for knowing how to code.
Nah. Well,
being a nerd is cool now.
It is. It's very cool, Ted. I was born in the wrong time. Although I aged like a fine wine. I'm cool now. I'm no longer. So I think that's actually better. You know, get being a nerd over early.
Yeah. What I think the most interesting thing about S3 is, though, getting back onto S3 is we call it the Simple Storage Service, but it's been around since 2006.
Yeah.
So is it so simple anymore?
Well, actually, that's a good point. You can argue that it's much more complex than it sounds, right? Because it has a lot of very interesting features. For example, different storage tiers, and tiers of storage means, you know, how quickly accessible files might be, or how durable those files might be, or how they're priced, for example. If you have something that's more easily accessible, it would be priced a little higher. Or if you have something that's really stored in an archival storage for longer term storage, it would be cheaper, right? So it has a lot of different options that are supported. It also allows you to do other different things, like hosting a website on S3, right? Static website hosting is an option. It's not just, you know, putting files into buckets anymore. It's a little bit more complex. What would you say to that question, Ted?
So, you know, when I look at S3 and what it is simple to get started with. But I think as you look at some of the options that are available, when you start looking at how am I going to encrypt my data at rest? How am I going to ensure that I have encryption in transit? How do I secure access, not just to me, but to these other entities, other parties, applications. You're adding complexity there. Because over time, the feature set has continued to increase, which I think is really impressive. The product just isn't static. But when we talk about storage and how it's high performing and scalable, I think one of the cool things to think about is how redundant is our data and how do we access our data in S3? So with S3, we're typically using HTTP and HTTPS to access our data. We call the data that we're storing not files, but we call it objects, because it's not just the file, but it's all the metadata with that file. An encryption key as well, maybe, with that file as well. So there's a lot more to it than just getting access to the file. And then how is that data redundant and how is it accessible? You know, one key topic that we talk about with S3 is that it has 11 nines of durability and 5 nines of availability. What's that mean?
Well, that's something that's very important to our customers, because if they put something in S3, they have confidence that it won't just disappear, right? This is something that we would call durability. So if something is in S3, if, for example, one of the availability zones or regions might have an issue, you won't just lose your data that you're putting in there. You have confidence that your data will always be there. And in terms of availability, it's just always having access to your data. In other words, you won't ever experience really like a true outage and be able to access your data in some other region if you have certain things enabled for S3. So that's very important for our customers that need things like replication or disaster recovery or multi-region support.
It's funny. I always heard simple as simply, because when I was using this a long time ago, it was like, I simply need storage. I don't need a database. And that always stuck with me of how I kind of looked at things. Am I just storing files and blobs and videos? And can I pull that kind of stuff out with, S3 or some kind of anything that's not basically a database? So this section, how much does this section with storage and compute count towards the exam? And does this section include things like relational databases, or is it these storage services that we look at around the topic of being highly performant?
Yeah, so
not that an RDS can't be, because
yeah,
it certainly
when we
has.
Talk about designing high performance architectures, that's 24% of the exam.
Oh, okay.
For the solutions architect associate. Is it just storage? Oh no, we've got multitudes. What do we have? 5 different storage types if we just want to get started, right? We can also talk about Elastic File System, EBS, Elastic Block Store, FSx. So lots of different ways of storing our files. And then we have different compute solutions, EC2, Lambda. And then Dave, as you mentioned, we've got database solutions as well. You know, so there really is a lot to this topic. And I think it's sort of interesting because on this exam, a lot of the product categories, like if we talk about S3, well, you may have a question that relates to designing a high performance architecture, but you could also have a question relating to using efficient cost management tools, where the same product is going to show up in a different way.
So, Ted, I want to think about, I think you mentioned 5 initial storage solutions in regards to high performance. How do I know when to use what?
That's a good question.
It depends.
Yeah, it depends. That's the typical instructor answer.
I'm supposed to be the consultant. You guys are taking my line.
Yeah. So let's talk about a couple options. So let's talk about Elastic Block Store, EBS. This is block storage, where we have, you know, unrelated blocks of disk space that are arranged by the OS. And so I think of EBS as being a great place for something like a boot drive on an EC2 instance. And then when we look at the redundancy for EBS, it is within its high performance storage that's available within one availability zone. It's typically
so not
mapped.
as durable.
I'm going to say not as, not as durable as S3, which is stored across multiple availability zones. Okay. S3, on the other hand, is more of an object store. I like to think of S3 as being serverless because I don't have to manage a file server or an OS with S3. And then we've got EFS, Elastic File Store. EFS is, I think of a shared file system. If I needed, a home directory for all of my 100 users across multiple instances, a place, a shared storage to persist data. It's very much like Block Store, but this is a little bit more redundant. And that's available across multiple availability zones.
And the other thing that is making EFS very useful in the context of building application is that you can connect, you can have multiple EC2 instances connect to the file store, right? So in other words, if you're looking to utilize some of the same files, you're able to connect to the same EFS instance and perform operations on those files, versus EBS is really only limited to one. It's kind of, it's a one-to-one match there.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, there are a couple weird one-off use cases for EBS to be multi-attached, but the limitations are very strict on that.
Yep.
So EFS also, and again, having that file store across multiple availability zones really lets you get some resilience with your compute.
Yeah, so, that's when I first saw EBS was messing around with EC2 instances.
Which makes sense, because that is the type of storage you would use for a boot volume, where you would install an operating system. Anything that comes along with a server, it goes onto a block store. So it makes total sense that you see those in the same context, Dave.
Yeah, so you know, we're talking a little bit about this, and we've talked about some storage solutions. Let's talk a little bit about databases. Does that sound?
I like databases, Ted. Let's do it.
I think databases are pretty cool. One of my favorite courses that I get to teach is a 3-day database course where we just go into databases and play with about a dozen different databases. So anyone can launch an EC2 instance for compute and install a database server of their choice on that. Why do we choose a managed database solution?
That's a good question.
Because patching crushes my soul.
Exactly. It hurts.
That's called self-managed, right? That choice would be called a self-managed database. And that's exactly what that sounds like. You manage it yourself. So anything that you install on the EC2, it's back to that shared responsibility model. We've mentioned that before, I believe, to where we have AWS responsible for certain things in terms of security and the customer being responsible for other things, right? So if you're doing it self-managed on an EC2, the customer just takes on the onus of maintaining upgraded operating systems on the EC2, making sure the latest patches are installed, and anything that would essentially keep things up to date. And that's all on them. They have to take care of that.
Sounds like you're volunteering to be a firefighter for that EC2 instance.
And I guess
happy to do it if it pays well.
Well, exactly. But here's the question. Does managing your own backups, managing clustering, patching the OS, patching the database server, all this sort of mundane data center work, does that make your product better?
Not so much. I mean, this is just stuff you got to do, right? It's just comes with the territory. If you want to do it, go for it. But it takes time away from your team. So typically, if you're a very small team and somebody needs to do that, that's valuable time.
Yeah, and time's money. What do we call that? Undifferentiated heavy lifting, right?
There is that word.
Around that, is there something that can help us to reduce the undifferentiated heavy lifting?
Yeah, so I've used the acronym RDS, so I guess I should say what the acronym's for. So that's Relational Database Service. And I think this is a really cool service because it lets us... I think of it as an engine that can run 7 different databases. So you choose your relational database of choice. If you want to run MySQL, Postgres, Microsoft SQL, IBM DB2, I know that's still a thing, Oracle. You take your database as well as our own proprietary Aurora database. But if you take this database and it's deployed for you, you don't have to install the server.
Or maintain it.
Yeah. And if you want to build redundancy, like multi-AZ redundancy, where you have one DNS name, and if your instance should fail in a certain availability zone or the availability zone becomes unavailable, all of your writes have been simultaneously written to another instance. And you just pick up where you left off with minimal downtime.
So if you didn't have that, let's say you were doing self-managed databases on an EC2, what would that mean? Like, how would you be able to reproduce the same exact thing without the RDS service? Is that easy, difficult?
I think that would be a lot more difficult, as you'd have to build up another instance, install that in a separate availability zone, figure out the clustering, manage the DNS records for an automatic failover, and set up the replication between the two hosts.
And in regards to high performance, what does this mean in terms of scaling, right? Managing your own or doing one of our managed service databases?
Well, I think scaling, when we talk about relational databases, one common way we scale is with read replica. So let's, if we have a read heavy workload, let's say I have a WordPress site where most of the data that's sent from that WordPress site are reads, as people are reading my cool blog posts. So let's say I have in the US during business hours, it's a business focused blog and we're very busy. So maybe I have a read replica that's only instantiated during the times that I'm busy.
I have to go find Ted's WordPress. What's he writing about?
I'm not telling.
He's got a lot of followers. Sorry, continue.
Oh, that's okay. My first experience with AWS was a WordPress blog, because I launched iPhone app and I needed a landing page. So I spun up an EC2 instance with WordPress on it, all self-hosted and self-managed on, you know, a single instance. Was that the best way to do it? Well, for the 10 people that downloaded my first app, it was fine. But as you grow, you need to build this redundancy and resilience into your app. You know, maybe that wasn't the best way to go for a professional landing site if my site had really taken off.
So let's go back to the read replicas. What other things can we do with the managed services to create that scalability?
There's a couple of ways we can scale, right? It kind of depends on your requirements, right? Going back to the types of scaling. So in terms of read replicas, that allows us to offload specific types of traffic, right? Which is read traffic. You can reroute it to that read replica. The other thing that we can consider doing is just scaling the instance too, right? There's the type of scaling that we would refer to as vertical scaling versus horizontal scaling. So vertical scaling would mean adding more resources to a server. So something like making the database bigger, like giving it more CPU and more memory capacity to perform certain operations. So if you suddenly need that, right, it's pretty straightforward to do it with a managed service like RDS. You can go in and choose a different tier of RDS in a different instance, and it scales it for you, which is pretty straightforward, versus doing it in something like an EC2 where you're doing it yourself. That's a little more complicated because you have to, again, choose a different instance, reinstall things, so that becomes much more complicated. So that's another advantage that a managed service would have in terms of scalability, right?
Yeah. One other thing that I would consider for scaling is caching. If we are getting the same request, let's say I was a site that gave the current weather data. Well, everyone in Miami is checking the same weather over and over again. If we can tolerate slightly stale data, serving a request from memory is 50 times faster than doing a query against an SSD. So this is another, you know, option that we can use and look at to help scale.
Yeah. And do we have specific services we wanted to highlight for managed services, for that matter, that we wanted to highlight for that, Ted?
Yeah, we have ElastiCache, which we can use with RDS. And just like RDS, we can choose an engine to use for caching behind it. So it's a managed service to manage Redis or Memcache. Or do you call it Memcache D? Some people geek out and they call it one or the other. I never know what to call it.
Yeah, and I always pronounce things wrong too. That's just I forget who. Oh, it was Brooke, and we were talking about how to say. Oh, I can't think of the word. It was a service, and they were like, "Is that how Americans pronounce it?" And I was like, "No, that's how Dave is." So please don't try and find American pronunciations for things. I used to say archive instead of archive for the longest time. Yeah. And it's funny. It's like all these games I play too, you never hear things pronounced. And then you actually hear the game developers will say things. And you're like, oh, that's what it's called. And you had me thinking about, and you can tell me if this is still a thing. When it came to performance, a lot of the ways that I used to architect these systems was looking at the type of data and the type of communication. If it was an asynchronous communication, I would get into things like queues and sure. using messaging queues and being able to pull things back and forth. And, you know, if the data really needed to be fast, there was something called NoSQL, right? Where you're looking at table structures and you get into things like DynamoDB and other things versus trying to do relational queries. Does that all fit into this? Is looking at the type of data and looking at messaging services too?
Oh yeah, definitely, Dave. Relational databases have hit some limits. The whole idea behind NoSQL, SQL or structured query language, is the syntax that we've been using since the 70s to query these relational table structured databases. And as we've gotten to internet scale businesses, those relational databases just have not been, in some use cases, as effective. As our table size increases, as our database size increases, queries tend to slow down. And our query response rates start to suffer as our database gets larger and larger. So yeah, that's a great sort of segue into NoSQL databases. So these are a variety of different database types and structures that address some of these limitations or constraints that relational databases have.
Yeah, and the other thing to note about NoSQL databases is it allows for more flexibility in data structures, right? When you're building out a schema for a SQL database, you kind of need to know it up front. Right? Like what kind of fields you're going to have in your table, what are the primary keys, things like that, when you sort of define your table. For the NoSQL databases, it allows you the flexibility to add new fields as you're continuing developing and storing new types of data in the table. So you can accommodate different types of data as your application evolves, which is really great for developers, right? Because if they're introducing new data types, they don't have to be reworking their backend data architecture. And it just allows them more flexibility with how they do things, which is another important thing to note on the NoSQL front.
Yeah, if I were creating my new social networking application, maybe I would look at a different type of database like Neptune, which is what we call a graph database. So another type of NoSQL database where, you know, Bob and Tony like these types of restaurants and their friends. How would you query that in a relational database? It'd be a pretty long query to find out who of my friends like this type of restaurant. But with a graph database, we can query the graph and the relationship as part of the data that we can query, as well as the likes and dislikes. You know, so again, we have these purpose-built databases. And one of the really interesting things that I see is a lot of our customers don't choose just one database anymore. In the old days, I had an enterprise license for SQL Server. So, you know, it's that old saying, you know, if the only tool you have as a hammer, everything looks like a nail. So if I ever had a database issue, I use the same solution. Well, here you've got, you only pay for what you use, and you've got a variety of solutions. So choose the best tool for the job.
Yep. So in other words, going back to the high performing and scalability aspect, right, of NoSQL databases, as the architecture continues to scale, depending on the application, it's definitely behooves you to consider if a NoSQL database may be a better fit if you know that your applications will scale to millions of users, because they can be much faster to perform these queries. What about the redundancy aspect, Ted, in terms of some of these databases that you called out, like Neptune or DynamoDB?
One of the really cool aspects of some of these NoSQL databases like DynamoDB is that we've decoupled the compute from the storage. So, and DynamoDB is serverless. And what that means is that, not that there aren't servers, of course there are servers, but we're not worried about instance sizes and how long we're running the CPU. We just pay for the data that we use. But one of the really cool things here is that we use this sort of cluster volume, and our data is replicated across multiple availability zones. So we have this resiliency. If there is a failure with an availability zone, or there's a problem, we have redundancies there. That's really hard to be able to achieve if you're doing your own on-prem database.
Yep. So it kind of falls back into the concept of a managed service that kind of comes with it. So the fact that you're using a managed service, you're already benefiting from the fact that it gives you some of this resiliency out of the box, which is great.
Right. And you're not worried about things that you would worry about with a NoSQL database on-prem, like how am I sharding my data? You know, and how do I want to distribute this data across my storage network? All of that's taken care of for you.
So another opportunity to get rid of that undifferentiated heavy lifting.
Yes.
Does this exam cover like the physicality of regions and availability zones and how that fits into having a high performant, resilient architecture? For example, do I have a facility in the US? Am I using, you know, like even CDNs where you're getting closer to where you need to be for the end customer? Does that come into play in the questions of how you've physically set this up across the different regions?
Yeah. And the way I would say that is that in the cloud practitioner exam is much more foundational. So you'll be straight out asked, what is an availability zone? What is a region in the scenario questions? In this exam, you're going to be expected to maybe choose in the scenario the answer that includes multiple availability zones. So you're not going to be asked explicitly what is an AZ, what is a region.
Got it.
But you're going to have to choose the solution that uses multiple AZs or maybe multiple regions even, depending on the scenario they give you.
Yeah, and when would something like that become important, Ted, in terms of considering different regions? Like, we definitely talked about availability zones, right? Like, in terms of having more resilient and available architectures. But when would regional concerns come into play here?
Yeah, I think some important things to know about regions are that AWS is never going to move your data from one region to another.
And that's okay. Very important, because for a lot of our compliant customers that run regulated workloads, if they need to be in a particular region, they need to have confidence that they're staying in that region and have no question about where their data is floating in the ether. Like, they need to know that it's in the region that they've selected. So that's super important.
Yeah. And what I mean by that statement is, yes, you can replicate your data to another region, but there's a nerd knob that you as the customer have to turn.
And I imagine when making this decision about how to architect and picking your region, this is a big factor in making something that is high performant, right? So how can we you know, kind of take something that we know about our customers. Maybe they're all based on the East Coast. I'm in New York. Maybe they're all based in New York. Like, how do I want to start building this application or building that's where my mind goes, my storage solution?
One of the key factors that we use to determine where we're going to locate, what region we're going to locate our infrastructure in, is how close are we to our customers? It would make no sense to choose a region in Sydney if your customers are in New York, right?
It's all we want about to be a user experience, right? We want to push back from our users.
No, and I think that's really important when we talk about performance. I don't know that that's the only reason why we would choose one region over another. I think, you know, the regionality and regulations, you know, data governance and data sovereignty very much play a role into where we choose to house our data and what regions we choose.
Yeah, I would say compliance is probably the next second big reason that if not the first, that I see why customers would choose a region that they do.
Another thing that I'll say is not all services are available in all regions. And that isn't a bad thing. You know, if we have a new region just open up, not every service is going to be available in that region on day one. And we're not going to hold up introducing a new service just because it's not going to be instantly available in 33 as of today regions.
Yeah. And as I'm following along here, there's a bunch of different services. We got into serverless. We looked at, regions. We looked at cache. We looked at the types of data. Let's say I'm going through this. And as a customer now, I'm like, you know what? Because one of the things you said, Ted, was like all of the different kinds of databases that really stuck with me is that I can have different kinds of databases within my own architecture. It's not one size fits all anymore. And is there something, one, because it's, you know, all about the exam, are there questions on the exam? And then two, services related to helping me as a customer get off one of those databases that's not being performant. I want to actually use another option. How does that all come into play?
Well, that's a great question, Dave. We have migration tools to help our customers move, not just from on-prem to a managed solution, but from maybe a self-managed solution in the cloud to an RDS database as well, or to a NoSQL database. We have a tool called DMS, which is our database migration service. And this is a really cool tool because, you know, one thing I think of is if I were going to move a database, and I've done databases in production, can't I just back up this database, copy it out to AWS, and then start a new database from that backup? The answer is yes, that is one way of doing things. But what if I have a live database that I'm trying to migrate and I want to have a smooth cutover? So can I replicate that database and as it's updating, have my copy in the cloud continue to update? One of the things that the database migration service does for us.
That's pretty cool.
Anya, you've used this service.
Definitely, yes. A lot of customers who have database migration or storage migrations from on-premises, that happens to be a lot of life sciences customers that begin in labs, and they generate lots and lots of data from their instruments. Then they find that migrating to a cloud-based storage would be a better long-term choice for them, but they're concerned on how to have uptime as they're continuing to do their daily operations. And that's where DMS can really shine. They can migrate some of their data in bulk and essentially bring it over as a one-time migration, but then continuously do that CDC or change data capture behind the scenes to continue replicating the changes. So that's definitely something we see our customers using all the time.
And when I just think about, go ahead, Ted.
Oh, I was just going to say there's another tool that works with DMS that we call our schema conversion tool that, well, let's say you're migrating as part of you're moving to a different platform. So you want to go from whatever relational database you're running to DynamoDB or to MySQL or to Postgres. Well, the database structure is going to be different. So this will help you set up a destination database and these mappings as you're doing this migration.
That's pretty cool. I imagine that's a lot of manual work. My mind was going to thinking about having two writers and changing the data across both databases. I imagine it gets pretty hairy. So, Ted, walk us through. My favorite part always is when we get to tie everything back together and look at a sample exam question.
Yeah, I've had fun with this one today. So let me get started here. A broadcast company runs an online voting system during contests in a live TV show. During the show, viewers submit hundreds of thousands of votes within minutes to a front-end fleet of Amazon EC2 instances that are running in an auto-scaling group. The EC2 instances write the votes to an Amazon RDS database. However, the database is unable to keep up with the requests that come in from the EC2 instances. A solutions architect must design a solution that processes the votes in the most efficient manner and without downtime. What solution would meet these requirements?
Very realistic question.
Yeah. And I'm thinking about this. When I was thinking about building this question, I was thinking, okay, so I've got a web front end and it auto scales and we're accepting all the requests, but the database isn't able to handle these bursts in traffic.
Ted, you gave me a trigger there. Here's a little memory. This is in my Alexa days. I'm on stage and it's like a keynote interview at Forrester. Okay. And they let the audience of thousands of people, it's this exact scenario, ask Dave any questions live. And I was like, I didn't know this was coming. So on stage, and they must have used some kind of cue. So maybe there's a cue that fits in here. Because what was happening is you would see the numbers go up and then people could up and down vote. And almost everyone was privacy. So I kind of like saw my career flash before my eyes, but I handled it well. I had media training and we did have good answers around it. So I kind of see this scenario like that of not everything is coming in at once, or all of a sudden there's 1,000 things a second coming in. You can't really determine the inbound.
Yeah. So what do you think would be a good way to address this, Anya?
Well, I would not go the route of just increasing the database size here, right? That's certainly an option, but we don't want to do that because if you increase the size of your database, you're paying more, right? It's tedious to do that. That's extra work that you don't want to be handling. And then you'd have to scale it back down, right? So that just doesn't fit the scenario here. So what we want to do instead is we want to think about an approach where we can keep the database size static as it is to be able to handle the workload, but offload some of that pressure on the database that's coming in with this huge influx of requests, right? So these are not read requests. These are actual write requests. So we would not be benefiting from something like a read replica that we discussed earlier in the episode. We actually want something that on the front end, so they can be processed one at a time over time, right? So we don't overwhelm the database. So in this case, I would look at something like a queuing solution, as you have mentioned, Dave. So I think that's a great fit here as requests are coming in. They can be stacked in a queue and can be processed in something like a first in, first out order. So I would explore that route. What do you think, Ted?
I think that would be perfect. I think Amazon SQS, Simple Queue Service, is definitely worth looking at for this scenario. Now, I also think of when I look at these test questions, there are always good distractors in there. So it's what's the best right answer sometimes. It's not what's the right answer.
Yeah.
So what else do you think would be a good distractor? You know, when we're talking about, you know, we've got EC2 instances that are running in an auto-scaling group, and we've got a back-end database. So we've come up with a good solution here with using SQS, I think, and having some worker instances maybe read the messages in these simple queuing service queues and then deleting them after they're processed. That makes sure the data gets in the database. But what do you think a good distractor would be?
We're talking about talking about the autoscaling group for the EC2 instances, which is related to compute, right? So I would imagine that there may be something about scaling another type of compute, especially serverless compute, to catch the reader's attention. So it may be something related to introducing serverless compute, something like Lambda instead, for allowing to quickly service those requests as they're coming in, to maybe, let's say, have an API gateway set up where you have each request being serviced by an API gateway endpoint with a Lambda function backing it, and that allows you to scale, which is actually a really good approach to doing the compute part, but it doesn't really address the database part, right? Because you have a lot of scalability on the compute, but doesn't address the issue that your database is not scaling. So I would think that that's a good distractor there.
And Anya, I just want to clarify one thing. For some of the folks who are listening who are maybe just starting out, I want to actually go back to why we need to scale the database. We've said it, but I want to just say it a little bit more straightforward, right? It's an issue where we don't have enough writers, right, to actually write to our database. It's not an issue of not having enough storage. So I think we keep talking about how scaling isn't the right solution, but it's a solution. And I want to clarify really what the crux of the problem is here in this question, especially for some people who maybe haven't had that context in real life yet.
Okay, we can step back a bit. So in terms of the database, right? So the question specifically states that the EC2 instances here are writing the votes from the online voting system into an RDS database. So we do have a database, and we instantiate that database by selecting a specific tier of compute and memory, right? And you give it some kind of CPU power and RAM power, so it can take a certain amount of requests, right? Each request will take some amount of that compute to process and some amount of memory to handle that connection. So if you have a lot of them coming in, that can result in your database being bogged down and overwhelmed and not being able to handle all of these requests coming in from the EC2 instances, right? So this is what we're trying to solve for here, because the database cannot handle that influx of requests all at once. Is that a little more clear, Caroline?
Yes, thank you. Right? It's not a storage capacity. It's a, help me out with the word here.
Provision compute capacity.
Correct. There we
go. So, you know, when we, most of the solutions that we use with relational database service, we choose an instance type. So we're going to say this is the, you know, for lack of a better word, this is the server size that we are using for our database servers or instances, our virtual machines out there. So,
is there a thing too with like Amazon RDS with these writes? Like I'm thinking in terms of blockchain, like Solana always talks about TPS, right? Like it's transactions per second. Is RDS something where like it promises that TPS, like you can do these many writes per second and then I can pay more to get better write performance? Or is it kind of like hard capped per service? And so those kind of writes per second, you'd want to look across different data services.
Well, we can actually, with RDS, with the instance-based types in RDS, we can provision storage. And we have different types of storage, just like we have with EBS volumes on EC2 instances. We can choose different IOPS. And the idea here is that you're paying more for more input-output operations per second. Again, though, I think in this scenario where we've got a limited period of time where we've got a big spike in traffic, do we have time to, do we want to keep our instances at this, you know, scaled up to this high size for a long period of time? Or does it make more sense to put these database writes in a queue? It might be a little bit more cost effective as well as performant.
And easy because the SQS or simple queue service is actually serverless. So you don't have to really manage it, right? You instantiate it, hook it up, and that's it.
Would that be like a question too, where it's saying, what is the most scalable solution that gives the biggest cost savings? Would they combine two into that kind of question?
Sometimes, and they sometimes might even preface it, what is the most operationally efficient solution, in the sense that it, what would be the most, you know, efficient approach from, like, let's say a DevOps individual perspective, right? They don't want to be going in and like reinstantiating the RDS instance, scaling it up and then scaling it back down. That's a pain. But if you had SQS queue in there, they would set it up and then they don't think about it. It just takes care of itself.
It's automated. Yeah.
Yeah.
Got it.
I think most of the time though, you'll see one qualifier. The scenario can be quite complex, but then they narrow it down with the qualifier, the most cost effective, the most operationally efficient. To help you choose between the two distractors or the multiple distractors in the end.
Always lots of distractors on these exams, but gets you really good at test taking.
Yeah. When in doubt, choose C.
Is that your official guidance?
My official guidance is answer every question. Don't skip any.
You
and
do
then come back and think about it.
You do not get penalized for wrongfully answered questions. So definitely click. Even if you're at the very end of your time, take your best guess.
Awesome. Well, those are two amazing pieces of parting wisdom. Thank you guys for imparting all of these great tips and tricks with us today. Please join us for our next episode, which will be designing cost-optimized solutions. And hopefully they come out together and you could just go on and click next. Keep on listening to this fun group.
Thanks,
thank you.
Caroline. Thanks for
having me. Take care, everybody.
Thank you.
Welcome back to the Developer Podcast. This is the fourth part of a five-part series, Getting Schooled in Architecture.
It's not. We got to start over.
Oh, no. It's not
it's six.
The fourth. Oh.
It's six.
Oh, no.
That's okay. That's fine. That was good. I'll edit this all out. We'll go ahead and kick it off again. Unless we want to drop the sixth, but I think the sixth will be the big finale. Right?
No, I think
a recap would be good at the end.
Yeah. 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 Okay. So you got to count. I didn't mean to throw you off. Just
no,
say
no, no.
In a six-part series.
Six-part series.
That was great,
though. I thought it was six parts.
Sometimes our brain just acts weird.
Today, we are going to be covering designing cost-optimized architectures. And if you haven't had a chance to listen to our past three episodes,
it's high-performant architectures.
No. Oh, I don't think I could do the whole thing again.
Oh my gosh. I just want to give you a big hug. It's all right. You're doing great. You were like perfect through that. It's just the high-performant.
So should I just say today? Do you think like it could be an edit or should I do the whole thing?
You can, no, you can, I can totally edit it for you.
Okay.
So wherever you want to pick up is fun.
Oh no. All right. I'm like looking at all the things and I'm like, this is the fourth one, but it's, I understand. Okay.